board brought in twice as much money as we spent on the program. So we do have a request in here, again, it's on the county side, to add another $200,000 so that all the families participating in that employment program have access to rent assistance. Our expected reduction, 5%. Ours is a balanced system. You can't take $888,000 out of one place and not cause unintended negative consequences for other parts of the system. So our proposal is to take proportionate cuts in shelter, in housing placement, and in some support services. So you can see here what the impact would be. And then finally, we have our family system by the numbers. So this is just one illustration of how our budget breaks out when you look at it through the lens of a particular group of people needing support. An investment in shelter for families of $2.2 million, and diversion of $800,000, and so forth and so on. And there isn't magic. There isn't a formula that I can apply that says this is exactly the right proportion of funding in each of these buckets. But it does represent intentional strategic work on the part of Home for Everyone work groups and the Homeless Family System of Care's oversight group that routinely looks at budget and how resources are being allocated and makes recommendations. And here on the unmet need front, of course, we're tracking unmet need across the populations, but on families, we have 600 families right now in the queue looking for permanent housing assistance. 211 is getting about 1,000 calls a month for rent assistance, emergency rent assistance. And of course, we know that we have hundreds of families on the wait list for shelter right now. So our priorities going into 19, we had an audit this year on the county side, and we're prioritizing their findings regarding data access, quality, and reporting. Data was something that the budget office also raised in their report, and I appreciate that. We're going to put a good amount of effort into that in partnership with DCHS and PHB. We have to reprocure all of our adult systems. So we just finished a reprocurement of all of the money that goes into families. And on the county side, we have a requirement to reprocure all the resources that are going into the adult system, shelter, placement, supportive housing, this coming year. That's going to be a lot of work, but it's also an opportunity for us to think through how we're allocating resources in that system and design that system more effectively. We have our regional and local supportive housing plans that we need to finalize and begin to implement. We've just developed a chronic homelessness framework that we will also be working to implement. We have some struggles in the family system right now just in terms of the overwhelming demand from families. We're going to work to address that. And then we're committed to improving our equity work, both within a home for everyone and within the joint office.
So I have a question. So you have heard me state a preference, and this is not a guarantee, but a preference that we, for the most part, hold the joint office harmless in this budget reduction exercise. So let's just play a thought game. Let's take off the table for a moment the 5% cuts, the horror story you just laid out. You have a couple of ad packages, including one that's very specific to the city of Portland. One of the good news situations that came out of the legislative session was we went down there, we lobbied hard for the document recording fee to be increased, which it was. We went down there with the chair and argued for additional dollars to shore up the family shelter system. Would it be safe to assume that you could purchase some of these asks, given that we now have additional sources of funding? Or where would you propose those sources of funding go?
So I don't know yet what the impact of the document recording fee is going to be on us. So only a small percentage of the doc recording fee goes into the homeless-specific allocations, and then we get a percentage of that in Multnomah County. So I don't know what that looks like yet, but certainly that when that comes, that will be an opportunity for us to expand shelter capacity in our community with those dollars and or rent assistance, depending on how we choose to use them. The dollars that came to us from the governor were specific to addressing the family shelter need. And as you know, we have this tax title fund that the county is in our budget. And we had a three-year plan, because that's one-time funding, to spend that out to expand the family system. Because of the crisis we faced in our family shelter, with the numbers just being so high and our commitment to not turning any families away, we had to spend a significant amount of that dollar up front. So we're looking at those dollars coming in from the governor's office as a way to realize the commitments we made to expand the family system, in particular in next fiscal year. So right now I don't see those dollars creating an opportunity to do something on the alternative shelter side in particular, because those alternative shelters really are serving singles, right? Those pop-up shelter villages are all serving singles only at the moment.
Thank you.
Yep.
Rob, did you? Oh, sorry, Commissioner Saltzman, then Rob.
I was just curious what the. Oh, sorry, thanks. What the current status is of the Human Solutions Family Shelter that had the roof collapse or whatever?
Yep.
Yeah. What's going on?
Human Solutions is the owner of that building, and the county made an investment in to help them acquire it. So with the closure, both Human Solutions and Multnomah County have brought in people to do a capital needs assessment on that building to determine what it would take to get that building back up to where we could feel good about having people living in it. That process is underway. We haven't seen any numbers yet to give us an indication of how significant investment it would be. Human Solutions, I think, has all along had a vision, and we did too, of that being only a temporary site for homeless families, with the idea being that that land might be redeveloped as affordable housing within a reasonable amount of time. So that's part of the discussion as well. And critically important, all of the families who had to leave that building have been relocated into motels, and they're in two different motels, so Human Solutions has been able to take the staffing resources that they were using in that family center and provide support services on-site at the motels to the families. So we're looking at that building. I think there's a lot of interest in, given how long families are staying in shelter, longer than anyone had expected and certainly wants, that finding arrangements where they have more privacy than they were able to have in that setting is probably desirable. So we're in the midst of that planning process right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Rob.
Thank you. So I was wondering about the 4889 number for placements on slide 10, if you could break that down for us to in terms of what we're seeing on slide 8. So the street to housing percentage and the shelter to housing percentage, because I gather that the top box prevention corresponds to the 6139 figure. So I'm wondering, of the 4889 that are in the placements, how many of those people are going straight from street to housing, and how many of them are going from shelters to housing, and what percentages that reflects those populations, if you have it?
I don't, but I can get it for you. So that you're right about the 4889 being essentially the street to housing, shelter to housing. In our family system, we do move families who are doubled up and highly vulnerable into permanent housing from those doubled up situations. Mm-hmm. That shows up in that 4889 number too. So, but I don't have it broken out by population right in front of me. So I can get that. I can get that to you.
So your mentioning of doubled up makes me wonder, because when I look at the top number from page 7 for the overall homeless population in 4177, does that include doubled up people? Because
no.
I was on the impression that it didn't, right?
No.
So we're kind of talking about different populations here. I mean, populations confronted by the same crisis, but still. What does that number look like on slide 7 in terms of the homeless population if you include the doubled up folks?
So I appreciate you asking the question and calling that out, because I should have said it. So those numbers are all the HUD definition of homelessness, which is a narrow, and it doesn't, for example, align with the school district's definition of homelessness, which does include people who are doubled up. So we don't have a perfect number, unfortunately, to count doubled up. But the best we've been able to come up with using school data and TANF data and things like that is that it's at least 4 to 1. So you're probably, the number is closer to 16,000 a night. And again, all these numbers are conservative. You hear all kinds of estimates about how big an undercount our point-in-time count is. But it's definitely an undercount, and 16,000 is probably a conservative number. And again, that would be on any given night. So you're right that in terms of how we invest on the family, because it is disproportionately families who find themselves doubled up. It's why in the family system we use the broader definition of homelessness as a matter of policy and are able to pick up a good number of families who are double, not just doubled up, but doubled up in unsustainable or unsafe situations, right? So there are some doubled up situations that can be maintained, and we'd like to give everybody access to their own, you know, permanent housing unit, but we don't have the resources for that, so we have to prioritize within that population.
And just one final follow-up, which is, Director Jolin, do you, in looking at the crisis in our houseless population with the existing, what we know about new housing stock coming online, and particularly affordable housing stock, and pressure in the rental market, do you foresee this problem getting worse before it gets better?
Wow, that's a good question. I think the sort of conditions around us that we don't have control over, what's happening at the federal government, what continues to happen in our market, suggests that it's likely going to continue to affect more people rather than less in our community. How well we do it, you know, making our investments targeted, how we're able to work through the production processes that PHP is working so hard on, is going to determine just what that looks like. In our community, at least according to some research from the Zillow research folks, we were one of a handful of communities where the per capita rate of homelessness actually declined in the last, between 2011 and 2016. A lot of our partner cities, it went up. But in terms of just the sheer numbers of people who are going to be faced with homelessness, I think it's going to continue to be a big challenge.
Mark, can I ask a few questions? First of all, what's the average cost of placing an individual in a shelter bed per day?
Someone do the math. I think it comes, so what I can tell you is that the range, because our shelters differ and the populations differ, I think our range for per bed, per night, per year costs is anywhere from about $8,000 to $12,000.
Okay. And so the reason I asked, I started with a shelter bed, is that I think sometimes, look, the aggregate data in your report and the outcomes are fantastic, so congratulations and thank you for an excellent report. I think what's sometimes missing in our conversation with the public is, if we had an extra dollar, where would we spend it and why? And I wonder if, following this hearing, you could send us some additional data points and try to quantify sort of the average cost of placing someone in a shelter bed, the average cost of preventing someone from experiencing homelessness, so when we put short-term rent assistance in and we make that investment, and the average cost of getting someone into a permanent placement. Because I think the numbers, I think, help tell a story, a very compelling story. And I think what we've known over time is that short-term rent assistance dollar is really one of our most powerful tools. And if we can prevent someone from becoming homeless, that's a great outcome. So if you could give us sort of, you know, some numbers, even if they're just estimates. But I think it's important as we make forced choices to know, where do we get the biggest return for our investment. The second thing I wanted to ask you is, following up on what I asked the housing director, what's your number in terms of the current shortage of housing units at 0 to 30% MFI?
I think our number is the same number that the Housing Bureau has. I mean, we're all working with the same data. So, I didn't come with this most current data in mind. I think Director Callahan provided a number. We're tens of thousands of units short. I think we know that, and it's that will continue to be our biggest challenge.
And I think to the question that someone raised earlier, I mean, over 95% of the housing coming online in our community is either market or luxury. It's not housing that the population that you're addressing is ever going to have access to. So that's why we need robust subsidies. You made the observation that, unlike some peer cities, we've seen a decline in the number of people outside, per capita.
Per capita and the number of unsheltered.
Well, it has to be per capita to be meaningful. So it's per capita. So let's take Los Angeles for an example. Los Angeles is six times our population, roughly. They've committed to spending just under $5 billion to address homelessness. Today, they have twice as many people per capita classified as homeless than we do. They're at 55 going to 60,000%, and they've seen a 75% increase in 6 years. What's, just in very broad strokes, what's different about our approach compared to Los Angeles's approach?
That is hard to answer because I'm confident that Los Angeles, because they're a peer community and we learn from each other, has many of the same strategies in place and has done many of the same things that we're doing here. I do think the fact that we've been as intentional about our planning effort, not just for the last 3 years under A Home for Everyone, but also prior to that under the 10-year plan, where we made a commitment to supportive housing and created thousands of units of supportive housing and created the short-term rent assistance pool and brought providers together around a shared vision, the fact that we have sort of sustained that and we're a community that works as well together as we do, and I'm not saying Los Angeles doesn't, but I think our intentionality around sort of being at the table together, saying this is what we have, this is what we're up against, where do we put our dollars, what investments work, and listening to folks on the street, really understanding the importance of investing in the vision that people who are out on the streets have for themselves. When they tell us, this is my path off the street, we figure out how to invest in that. I think we get good outcomes as a result, and we're able to push back more effectively against some of these really significant headwinds that we have in our community. But again, you know, all that said, we still saw homelessness go up by 10%, so we have more than enough work to do.
Thank you.
If I could just add to the list. So you know, I have said many times that the budgetary contributions are not sustainable. Not because we don't support the work of the joint office. We strongly support the work. And not because we don't want to. We understand that homelessness is a significant issue in our community, and we're committed to addressing it. But the reality is at some point the city will go back into a recessionary environment, and it is very hard to continue to hold harmless the joint office given that. So as you look out 5 to 7 years, what kinds of strategies should we be thinking about to ensure that we can continue to make the kinds of investments or even increase the investments so we can add some of the services that you've made a good case for? What should we be looking towards in the future?
Well, and I think this is a place where we can learn from Los Angeles and some other communities that have sought both local and expanded state-level dedicated revenue streams to support not just the development of housing, but also the support services that people need. And I think it's a central part of the work that we're doing around our supportive housing plan development is to think through what's the scale that we need both to invest adequately in the 0 to 30 housing stock and also in the support services that it's going to take to get people stabilized in housing. I think that's going to be a really important conversation, not just locally, but regionally and at the state level as well.
Very good. And I would strongly encourage people to read a very provocative article that has just popped up in The Guardian, and it raises the question about whether this is like the Vietnam War. In other words, is this an unwinnable war? So I'd ask you the question, is this an unwinnable war?
No. I think this is a homelessness, the way we're experiencing it. You know, we can put an end to it, but we will need the support of the federal government. We cannot win it by ourselves. We can't win it even at the state level. But we know, and this is what's been so hard for all of us that invested so much in the national effort to end veterans homelessness, is it illustrated for us that if the federal government comes to the table with the dollars proportionate to the need, then with a combination of those dollars and our state and local investments, we can get to a point where we are functionally ending homelessness for veterans, for families, for youth, for adults with disabilities. But until that time, you know, we will have a system that meets the needs of a lot of people, but is not scaled. No matter how good the strategies are, we can't scale them enough to meet the level of need that's out there.
I would agree with that, and thank you for saying that, because I think that's a key component of the next 5 to 7 year cycle. And that article, by the way, is all about Los Angeles, so it's really interesting in that it takes a look at LA. But we have to be more direct in our approach, particularly with the federal government, on housing support, addiction support, mental health services, and other services that are critical to success at the local level. We have to be honest with the public. We're going to do everything we can. We're going to fight aggressively to end homelessness, but we cannot realistically do it with the federal government being not only not a participant, but in many regards working against us to get it done.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you for saying no. I believe that, even though my staff do not believe the same. I have a couple of questions. One is, what are we looking at, or what are we trying to learn from Salt Lake City? I understand that they are more successful at ending homelessness than most of the cities in the West Coast.
They're actually more successful at branding and marketing. That's a good question, but really...
Their skiing is good.
So they made a one-time, very significant investment in permanent supportive housing that created a one-time significant reduction in chronic homelessness. And that was, you know, I think, to be celebrated. And it's the kind of thing, you know, we want to do here as well. And the reality is that since they made that one-time investment, because of the nature of homelessness, which is that it's a continuing crisis, even as we house people, new people become homeless, they are now facing an enormous homelessness crisis in Salt Lake City, and have come to visit us to ask what we're doing here. And are, you know, it's the number one top priority for their local elected officials. They've got major issues around livability that they're trying to address. So this is not an issue that any community, any local community, can solve. We can all learn from each other and do better with the scarce resources that we have, and we should learn from each other. But I'm always skeptical if any one place or one idea gets held up as sort of the thing. If we did it, it would solve the problem. I've never found that to be true.
And what's the indicator for chronically homeless?
So the HUD definition of chronic homelessness is that you've either been homeless for a year continuously, or four times or more in a three-year period, and you have one or more significant life-limiting disabilities that can include a mental health, physical health, or addiction disorder. Locally, we have a little more flexible definition, because we know that there are folks with significant support service and deep affordability needs who might not technically fit the definition of chronic homelessness, but very much need to be part of our strategy for delivering those kinds of supportive housing resources to folks, or they're going to wind up becoming chronically homeless if they're not already.
Thank you. And you didn't mention children. Mm-hmm. In the statistic of homelessness.
So I didn't mention children in the stats. That's because in the 2017 point in time, we didn't actually see a significant increase. We were pretty stable with the number of families. What we did see, because of the no turnaway policy for families, was a pretty significant decrease in unsheltered families and kids. But in the system, we still serve, I think, 5,700 kids last year under the age of 18. So it's very much a need out there. It just doesn't show up. And again, family is definitely one of those populations where the point in time count doesn't do a great job of capturing it, because we know families are so disproportionately doubled up. And it's also one of the reasons that we don't have a lot of confidence in the racial disparity information, ultimately, that it's adequate. In the point in time, because we know that families that are doubled up tend to be disproportionately families of color. So there are lots of reasons not to get too invested in the point in time count data. It's some of the best data we have, and it is imperfect.
I have a last one.
Yeah.
Veterans.
Yes.
How are we doing after our one-time investment?
So we're continuing to house a lot of veterans, but we had some 400 veterans still experiencing homelessness. So, you know, again, that system is much closer now to the scale that you need to offer veterans as they become homeless a housing option, but we haven't seen the kind of sort of continued scale of federal investment that it would take to maintain our achievements there. So we're working really hard to do everything we can with that resource, and there's money in our budget here locally to continue the work. And we did get a renewal of the current grants from the federal government. So that's good. That means we can at least sustain the capacity. So there's progress there, but it's still not a perfect system.
So thank you very much for all of your work. Thank you to you and your team. I think it's really commendable that you've served more people than you were planning to, and that you're continuing to use this data-driven approach. I particularly liked the slide on slide 15 with the rent-assisted versus the comparison and the employment training, and that is obviously what we need to be doing more of. Just could you tell me how, in your assessment, the coordination with the cleanup team has been going, and what opportunities there are there for us to do that part better?
Yeah. So over the last, it's coming up on a year now, we have tried to be much more coordinated, and not just the joint office, but all of our outreach teams that are out there in the field with all of the agencies that are doing the public space management and the camp cleanup. So the police and PBOT and parks, there's a every morning at 8 o'clock on Fridays, we're on the phone together. The city is very transparent about, you know, what areas are going to be cleaned up, so we know what is sort of officially slated to be cleaned. But it's also an opportunity for everybody to talk about areas that are emerging as problem areas or people that they've seen out in the field who they're concerned about. So it's a very productive conversation, and where we've seen a lot of benefit is when, you know, Portland Police Bureau has their neighborhood response team and has their car that has folks that go out with mental health outreach workers and sort of engage together. And the sheriff's office now has their HOPE team, and those are specialized officers, and they work directly with outreach workers. So there's been a lot of benefit in that kind of skill building and relationship building amongst the outreach teams and the public safety officers. In our budget, there is one adjustment that we're making to our budget. It's not a new ask, but we're actually going to field a team of three outreach workers who are really just service navigators and partner them up in each of the police precincts, whose primary job it will be to engage when an area is going to be posted and cleaned up. The difference there is that we haven't historically done outreach that way. Our outreach teams have been primarily funded to do permanent housing placement. So they do the work of engagement around the camps, but they're not as able to be in multiple places on a given day, because once they've engaged with somebody, they're working to get them into housing, and that takes a lot of their time. So all of those partners who've been on the phone every Friday morning, they're feeling like, you know, this is an important collaboration, but we've also heard it would be good to have a team that's dedicated to that part of the work so they can more efficiently put their time towards the housing placement and stabilization work.
Frida?
Being in East Portland, I'm reading the news, and questions come up by the community, and I know that you're planning or hope to plan having a shelter on Foster. Mm-hmm. How many is that going to serve?
So the Foster shelter, I think we're hoping we can accommodate about 120 people there.
Okay. The one on 122nd and Gleason that is run by Transition Projects, I believe, that was supposed to be temporary because of zoning, and there's rumblings that that's going to be closing. Are you looking at that happening? It's not the best building to have people in. Right. Looking at that closing when the Foster opens, or are you looking at another shelter to open?
So ever since we opened Hanson, which is the one on 122nd and Gleason, we knew it was not a long-term site. The building just wouldn't sustain it. It wasn't purpose-built for that. It was old, so we really weren't able to make a lot of the capital improvements you would want in a permanent year-round shelter. So we've been actively looking to replace that capacity in the community. So been trying to figure out how to add 200 beds of more high-quality year-round shelter. And so the Foster would be part of that capacity. We've also, as you likely know, been looking at a potential new shelter in Old Town that would also provide some of that capacity. So the plan remains to close Hanson down as soon as we're confident that we're not losing capacity in the community for that critical adult shelter.
And one thing on budget, as Sho pointed out, on Gresham, they're on the front page as supportive of your slide.
Oh, I see. That was the that was the reference. That's for the yeah.
But it appears in the budget it's Portland and the county that is really, besides your other sources. I'm assuming because you're countywide, you're also servicing Gresham,
yes.
Troutdale, Fairview, Wood Village. Are they giving you some kind of in-kind support? Because it seems like we're picking up their share as well instead of them picking it up.
So you're right on all counts. So Gresham is there because Gresham is part of the Executive Committee of A Home for Everyone and is part of our community planning effort. So Commissioner Eccles sits on the Executive Committee. There's a designee from the City of Gresham who participates in all of our planning work. And we've had members of the faith community and others from Gresham come to the table and help us sort of strategize for how to better serve East County. So the smaller jurisdictions don't currently contribute funding into our budget. Gresham does leverage some of their general fund and federal dollars, so they've got a we fund some outreach and they fund some dedicated police officers, and there are a variety of ways in which our investments are leveraging Gresham resources. I'm not aware of anything similar with the smaller cities. And I think the in-kind is also in the contribution of a variety of types of efforts. We have a lot of shelters that we don't fund out there that get a lot of support from the Gresham community and the East Multnomah County community, a lot of projects that aren't ours necessarily but do absolutely add value. So My Father's House, for example, is a really critical sheltering resource in Gresham for families. We don't fund them, but they draw a lot of support from the Gresham community. So, you know, I don't know if that helps put it in context, but right now we're not seeing direct funding into our office from those smaller cities.
And you mentioned the amount of families that is in greatly in need. How are you? I know at one time your commission, your public body, whatever you want to call it, it didn't have any school personnel on it because I did see a request out there seeking members who had school knowledge. Have you included that knowledge because they can be such a great partner? Someone from the school environment who can explain the intersections and the impacts.
So we didn't get anybody in that solicitation from to the coordinating board.
You actually did because I applied.
Oh.
Never heard back, but I applied because I do have that joint.
Well, let's talk.
Why not?
My apologies. So let's chat after this. I'm happy to talk. We're going to run out of time. So I just will say that especially on the family shelter side and the family system side, lots of active engagement with the school districts.
Okay,
so I promised Pam when we could talk about this for days, but we're going to have to wrap it up. Pam.
Oh, you want me to do it? Well, Frieda stole my question. You always steal those questions from me. But I also just wanted to say that I really appreciate it. I don't have a lot of experience or knowledge about homelessness issues other than what I'm seeing in the newspaper and in discussions here. Not any real background in it. So I really do appreciate the way that these reports have been put together and your slideshows, both you and the Housing Bureau, on all of these issues. I think they really help us learn more about that, and I appreciate that, and I hope that you'll keep doing that so that I can increase my knowledge of that. So,
happy
you.
To. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you all very much for your time.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. So next up, we have the legal department, the Office of the City Attorney. And colleagues, we're obviously working through lunch. If people, you know, this is casual, so if people want to eat at the table, you know, there's no problem with that.
Except for the video.
Yeah,
city attorney. But we're only 15 minutes, so we're small.
So, our legal department charges us by the 15 minutes. So let's keep moving. Director East, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners, directors, and Budget Committee members. So as a smaller bureau, we have 5 minutes to do our presentation, and I can talk fast, but I don't think I can cover everything that's on this piece of paper in 5 minutes.
You take as much as you need.
Well, what I actually thought I would do is focus on a couple of areas. One is why we hope you won't take the 5% cut, and we're pleased that the budget office recommended against it. And then I'd like to briefly address our two ad packages, which the budget office also recommended against. We had proposed for our 5% cut package, hesitantly, the Legal Records Management Program, and that's a program that you all funded 3 or 4 years ago that has enabled us to implement the GovQA system to manage public records, our legal hold system to manage litigation records, the SMARSH system to do text archiving and social media archiving. We have an attorney dedicated to that, running that program, who's Jennifer Johnston. We have a paralegal, Carrie Wilton, who's also working full-time, as well as some additional staff. To get to that 5% cut without actually cutting even more core legal services than public records management, legal records management, is just not possible. And especially with the direction to hold revenue-generating programs harmless, because the other thing we would have looked at, again, reluctantly for a cut, would have been the collections work. So we hope you will concur with the City Budget Office that all of the progress we've made in that public records management is important, drastically reduces legal risk to the city, and should be continued. The two areas where we've asked for additional staff is in our professional support staff. And for the last several years, I've come before you and asked for additional paralegal and legal assistant support, and in the past for additional attorney support. We've gotten the additional attorney support in the past. Somehow we have not gotten, perhaps because it's just not very sexy to ask for paralegals and legal assistants, but they are really, really key professionals for us to be able to do our work cost effectively. And we have two areas where they could make a tremendous difference. One is our contracts review. We have to review virtually every contract that the city enters into. In 2006-07, that was 5,055 contracts. And for 2017-18, our estimate is 10,900. So the work has more than doubled. We still have two attorneys that do essentially all of that work. One of our attorneys that does the technology contracting review, and one that does everything else. And as you can imagine, with that workload increase, they are simply overloaded. They're also pinch points for us being able to be timely and responsive to your offices and the bureaus. And our most cost-effective solution for that is to add a paralegal to that team who would be able to do a lot of the more routine contract review, insurance certificates, all of the things that need to be there to protect the city, and could free up our attorney who does most of the rest of the contract review to cross-train and also have some capacity on technology contracting review. And I will tell you that the CFO, independently of this request, had come to me and said she was really concerned that that technology contracting was a pinch point and would be as she continues to re-envision the procurement function. So we think that adding a paralegal that can do highly skilled, high-volume work on some of the more routine contracting matters would allow us to much more cost-effectively use our attorney resources and continue to be very timely on those contract reviews. And I think the City Budget Office was generally sympathetic about the request, but their negative was that they didn't think it supported the mayor's priorities. And we may have not done a good job of showing why it does, in fact. But if you look at the priority areas of increase housing options, reduce homelessness, maintain critical infrastructure, enhance livability, increase public safety and police accountability, and pursue innovation and strengthening resiliency, I can name contracts that occur in each one of those areas and are absolutely crucial. We can't, you know, build more housing without contracts. We can't do innovation strategies. Our tech attorney recently spent a lot of time working on contracts for the AT&T sensors that has to do with smart cities, for example. So contracting is a key element for all of those things. The other area where we could be more efficient and cost-effective is in our collections area. And previously, until FY 12-13, we actually had the Revenue Bureau funding half an attorney to do collections work. That got cut. It was a down year. We have continued to increase the staffing on collections work, and we're taking general fund resources and doing collections work. We now have a total of 8 attorneys and staff for a five FTE equivalent working on collections work. And over the last 3 years, we've brought in approximately $2 million. Each of the last several months, we have been setting records on how much money we're bringing in. You did fund a paralegal in the bump that has enabled us to do that, and we took some vacancy savings and hired a temporary legal assistant, but we won't have those funds next year. And so that's our other ad package, is to make permanent the legal assistant and paralegal positions that we have on a temporary basis devoted to that collections work. We've also really looked at the work and have identified some efficiencies and ways we think we'll be able to do it more efficiently. So those are the main things that I wanted to highlight, because I think all of those staff ad packages, the collections ones, I think, will pay for themselves in the amount of money that we can bring in. And the contract one, I think, is the most cost-effective way to enable us to continue to review contracts, which are crucial for everything the city does on a timely basis.
Thank you. Great. Good presentation. Questions? Commissioner Fish.
Comment. So, I think it's fair to say that between Superfund and our utilities, we've been high consumers of quality legal services over the years. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank you for the superb legal advice we get on those very complicated matters.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
We have also added additional responsibilities like boards and commissions and public records requests and other things. So your office, in addition to managing a very active litigation docket, has other responsibilities. Do you have the right mix of staff to meet the ongoing needs of the city?
I think we have excellent attorney staff. You know, we've all been talking at the city about succession planning for a period of time. Our office has lost a lot of very senior people purely to retirements over the last 3-4 years, and we've hired a lot of wonderful newer lawyers who are raring to go. And so, yes, we're getting there. I mean, it's been a real transition period. But as I mentioned, we have for several years added attorneys and not added staff, and our legal assistants and paralegals are very highly skilled professionals, and we really can't do our work without them.
Thank you. Commissioner Daly.
I would just like to express my appreciation and support for the legal services to development services for vacant houses work.
Thank you. Yes, I think Dan Simon is the attorney who's primarily doing that work, and he's doing a great job, and I think some real progress has been made that has some livability benefits, and so thank you.
And in your report, it says that we've brought in over $737,000 in revenue through this program. Over how many years is that?
Well, I believe it's just only been 2 years since the program has been in existence.
Great. Thank
Christine's
you.
Telling me I'm right, that it's 2 years.
All right. Thank you. Good presentation. That helped lay it out for us. Thank you. Next up, special appropriations.
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners, Directors, Committee members. I'd just like to start by saying I hate doing these kind of things, so if I seem really nervous, I'm sorry. So I'm just going to read this very brief presentation. Special appropriations are primarily used for general fund expenditures that are not specific to a bureau and often provide citywide benefit. These include payments to non-city agencies, funding for some city programs, and some city set-asides. Some special appropriations are one-time allocations, while others are ongoing. In fiscal year 16-17, administration of special appropriations transferred from the City Budget Office to the Grants Management Division. In addition to the ongoing special appropriations allocation, funding was increased in fiscal years 16-17 and 17-18 for a competitive grant program. Since the inception of the competitive program, the city has received 311 applications and awarded 59 grants. The total requested budget for special appropriations for fiscal year 18-19 is $13,788,612, which includes $4.2 million in internal programs, $6 million in external programs, $3.4 million in ad packages. The ad packages for 18-19 are $884,500 in floodplain management, $153,914 in council transition, $17,507 for VOES, $2.1 million for infill implementation, accelerate ADU development, $62,000 for gang-impacted family team coordinator, $10,460 for OYVP staff representative reclass, $192,218 for COCAL PSEP, $78,646 for last Thursday. And I have Bureau staff available to answer any questions about the ad packages.
So I just had a question about why some of them are special appropriations. For instance, the Office of Youth Violence Prevention staff and the gang-impacted family team coordinator, why isn't that coming from the Office of Youth Violence Prevention?
So the Office of Youth Violence Prevention program was moved to special appropriations, I think, in fiscal year 15-16. I'm looking at Andrew. And I'm not, do you have a background on why that was transferred?
Yeah, was that your question? I missed maybe the second part of it. It's special appropriations, actually, for this, the same reason as we're talking about open and accountable elections, and we're talking about potentially putting that in special appropriations to the extent it moves commissioners. With the Office of Youth Violence and Prevention, it was a little bit cleaner to have it in special appropriations, even though it is assigned, you know, to the mayor's office. He could assign it out to somewhere else.
Okay.
So it's sort of a standalone function, and that was a convenient place to budget it.
Got it, okay. And then I noticed that apparently nobody asked for the $1 million line item for grants.
That's correct.
So how are you, I would hope you would consider continuing to do that, Mayor, because I think it's been a really great process. I had some questions actually about the council transition funding.
We'll ask Ben Smith to come up.
Name for the record, please.
Ben Smith, Office of Management and Finance.
Thanks, Ben.
So obviously we're going to have a changeover for the Commissioner of Public Affairs. What does the $48,000 technology budget include?
So that includes changing over the whole office on January 1st when the new staff comes in. So laptops, iPads, cell phones for all the staff. That also includes money for the interim transition staff for November and December for the new commissioner. So the current plan is that they would be on the fifth floor of the Congress Center. And so that's computers, phones, all that for that we're really renting from BTS for that time. And then all the labor costs associated with that transition.
Okay. And why isn't the computer set aside reserve fund covering the computer part of it?
So the current policy is that the reserve fund is capturing money on a five-year basis. So every year, they're setting aside money for that five-year basis of the computers being changed. For the council offices, they've been on a four-year cycle. So what that means is for the council offices, some of them have a negative balance for their transition funds. I've worked with some of your offices to add additional funding to make up that gap. Commissioner Saltzman's one where we haven't done that. So there isn't transition fund set-aside funds for those computer replacements
okay.
at the moment.
It seems we should standardize that, because if some of us are setting aside the money appropriately and some of us are not.
That's one thing I've addressed with Brendan, a potential to add some funding to that to get everyone at least up to a positive balance.
I think we should have a policy on that. Thank you for bringing that. Why doesn't City Hall rent cover things like paints, carpets, all that kind of stuff?
So there is major maintenance money in the transition budget. That's separate from, and costs that will be covered by facilities. What we're really asking for is those non-maintenance items to be covered. Where the Commissioner Saltzman's office gets a little more difficult is we haven't done a changeover in so long. So that's why you're seeing a higher budget there for some of the work that needs to be done in that office.
And I haven't been paying attention. I don't know if you've replaced the carpets in my office or not. I mean, aren't they on a regular maintenance schedule anyway?
There is a maintenance schedule, and I can take that up with Brian Eng and follow up with you on that.
In my defense, the carpet's a bit nondescript, so I'm not sure that anybody would be able to notice whether it had been changed or not, because we've been very careful and have not spilled things on it. Okay, I think that's my question about that then. Thank you.
Well, Mayor, can I follow up on that comment? What another unique thing about Commissioner Saltzman's office is he runs programs out of his office. So he runs the Children's Levy, he runs the Gateway Domestic Violence Center, and other things, which accounts for the different budget items in his office. Is it your intention to take those programs into the mayor's office?
I can tell you that with regard to the Children's Fund, that is my intention, and we're still in discussions with regard to the other.
Okay.
What about? And I will give up my carpet budget for the Pettigrove room.
One of the things that we want to just raise for council, this request is considerably larger than the transition budgets have been in the past. And I think there's a really important policy conversation for council to have about the level of transition services we want to provide as we go through these elections. And I know just one of the things to note, and we are, OMF's proposing in here to provide temporary office space for the folks, after the election and between that interim period. That is a discretionary expense, and not every elected official, in fact, I think most probably don't, get taxpayer-funded office space prior to taking office. There are, however, advantages to having transition staff and transition time. So there are definitely pros and cons on both sides. From our perspective, $150,000 in this budget environment was a little bit challenging to find, and so we recommended the lower amount of $75,000. But certainly this is much more of a conversation council needs to have about that standard level of support and make sure we enshrine that going forward.
And it's relatively new. When we came in, there was no transition funding for staff. We volunteered for my staff volunteered from the election until they came in.
When I was elected in a special election, I didn't even get a transition. I just I came
Here's
right in.
Staff.
And does your figure contemplate that there might be people who win the primary and therefore are looking for like 7 months of office space, or are you calculating it based on the assumption that these races are decided in November?
So the transition budget that was created has a November 1st start date, with the idea being I'd work with Tom and Carmen on identifying who their kind of key transition staff are and telling them either if they win in May, we have funding starting in November, or we're waiting until that November election, then they're actually starting a little later.
Okay, thank you.
Rob, did you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick one. So am I to understand that the new commissioner and their staff get all new equipment? It sounded like you were going to be purchasing all new equipment. And does all the existing equipment, assuming that not all of it is end of life, does that go back into the BTS pool? How does it work?
So they do. The policy has been that they do get new equipment. That's what we did for the last transitions for the mayor and Commissioner Udaly. I know BTS looks to either reuse that, or they do have a nonprofit, I believe, they deal with for equipment the city no longer uses, but making sure there's a home for it.
Frida?
A couple of questions, and they might be more addressed toward Andrew. Because I'm reading your notes. On all hands raised, you give a comment that you aren't recommending it because of citywide equity impacts. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, this was the proposed 5% reduction to the to the city's contribution. Asha, do you want to? Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Asha Bell Dubose for the record, and basically, All Hands Raise is a program that works with Portland Public Schools and other nonprofits to meet indicators for community-wide educational improvement benefits. So a reduction to their budget, their ongoing budget allocation, would kind of impact the partners that they work with and their ability to meet their indicators and goals.
So does that mean all the schools? Because you say Portland Public, you have to realize it's supposed to be countywide, All Hands Raise.
Yeah, I just mean the schools that they're partnered with. So the ones that they're partnered with that they you know, work with in a funding sense and they work with in a staffing sense, if we reduce their ongoing allocation, it'll impact the services they provide.
I'd like to know what some of the services they provide to the different school districts are, because I have to tell you, I've not been a supporter of this group, so I'd like to know that. Thank you very much. A couple other questions, and these, I think they're more addressed towards Andrew's group, is in Future Connect, you mentioned that it's mentioned the collaboration with PCC and 600 students. I think it's a great program. Curious if you work with any collaboration with Mount Hood, since David Douglas has the largest high school in the state, and we're in the Mount Hood area.
We'll have to talk to Future Connect and get back to you on that, unless you know offhand.
Okay, and my last question has to do with RAC. Mm-hmm. And I'm not against your 10% reduction, just more curious. It is region-wide, and we're putting in a significant amount of money into RAC. What do the Clackamas County, Multnomah County, those other jurisdictions put into it? Because it appears the money's dispersed through all of them. And it could be just a percentage.
Yeah, we can get back to you with specifics. I know last year, unless Multnomah County, I think it was about $150,000 or $200,000 contribution. But
so the point, hardly any, is the answer to your question.
Yeah.
Well, that would be my next thing, is if they're not equitably putting into it, but we're dispersing it out equitably, I think we need to be relooking at how much money we're putting into it, because they also get arts tax, if I believe.
No, in both questions. But we have someone, I think, from RAC who could answer those questions.
Okay, thank you.
Should we bring him up?
Is RAC making a presentation? They're just here.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think there are any presentations on the special.
Mayor, why don't we invite Jeff Hawthorne to come forward?
Jeff, do you can you shed some light on that for us, please? Name for the record.
Sure. Jeff Hawthorne, Interim Executive Director of RAC, and with regard to the counties, Clackamas County's investment is currently $135,000. Washington County's investment is $100,000. We do support the entire Tri-County region, but we track very closely where the dollars are coming from, and we invest those dollars proportionately in the jurisdictions where the funding comes from. So City of Portland money is invested only in the City of Portland, same for Multnomah County, and same for those other two counties.
That's not to say, Frieda, that we would love to be able to get more robust contributions from Washington County and Clackamas. Jeff, first, I have the honor of being the liaison to the Regional Arts and Culture Council, so I want to acknowledge this has been a very challenging year. The agency is going through a leadership transition, and we are currently interviewing finalists for the executive director position, so that's a huge undertaking. The board is developing a more robust equity agenda and is talking about raising very important questions about how we carve up the pie. Understandably, there are some important actors in our community that are concerned about that, and so it's a controversial subject. We have new board members. RAC has been extremely helpful in developing an arts affordability agenda. I could go on and on and on. Jeff has been the interim executive director during all this change, and I want to just compliment you for the work that you've done. But I also want to ask you about the proposed 10% cut, which I do not support. What practically does that mean in terms of programs you can no longer fund?
Well, it's certainly very disheartening to be one of the few allocations, if not the only allocation, being asked to take such a significant cut. We looked at our budget closely to accommodate the 5% cut, and it's difficult to take that cut without cutting our largest program, which is our grant-making program that can